All right. My name is David Fergie. I'm 38 years old. This is March 5th, 2020. We are in Las Cruces, and I am interviewing Tom Lott, and we are friends and coworkers.
And my name is Thomas Lott. I am 69 and three quarters. Today's date is March 5th, 2020, in Las Cruces, here with my friend Dave Fergie, whom I am interviewing also.
Well, if you're okay with it, Tom, how about we start with the beginning where we both started serving? And would you mind explaining when and where you were drafted into what you were drafted into?
I've been waiting years to tell this story to somebody. I graduated from high school in 68. That was the height of the Vietnam War. And I wasn't real excited about going into the military at that time, so I thought an alternative choice is college. As long as I stay in college, I had a deferment. So I went to college. I graduated from college in 72 and got a draft notice. So I didn't end up beating the draft at all. I just put it off for 4 years. I was the very last group drafted. I was drafted in December of 72. Wow. President Nixon ended the draft in January of 73. So my friends say, congratulations, you won. But some of my friends had opted to go to Canada. I thought, no, I owed an obligation to our nation. I said, no, I'm going to put my time in. Fortunately, though, we were drawing down on Vietnam. They'd started bringing people back at that point. I thought for sure I was going there. I did not serve in Vietnam, though. I came in right at the end and ended up serving at beautiful Fort Riley, Kansas. Oh, wow. But I thought for sure I was going to end up in Vietnam. I sold my car. I sold all my personal possessions, said goodbye to all my girlfriends, and said, this is the end, I'm sure. But as it turned out, I just spent time at Fort Riley and briefly overseas as well.
So did it feel, you talk about like saying bye to everyone, because at that point, Vietnam was not a mystery, and the consequences were definitely not a mystery. Yeah. Did it feel very like a very finale, or very, you know, that
actually
they were going
very much so. Yeah, uh-huh. As I said, you know, I sold off all my, you know, my car, all my sports equipment. I didn't want to be going with anyone in particular and steady, because I had heard so many horror stories of people, you know, not coming back, and I thought, no, I want to break up with anyone and everyone. I said, I don't want a steady girlfriend. I thought for sure I was going. I thought, this is not going to be pretty.
Mm-hmm. Was it with the Army then? Or?
Yes, it was with the Army, yeah. I talked to all the different recruiters, and, you know, I thought, yeah, I had a college degree, I thought, and, mm-hmm. you know, the Air Force and Navy would have been very attractive. I could have gone to Officer's Candidate School, but it would have been about a six-year commitment, and I thought I'd rather just... I was already 22 at the time. I thought, I just want to put my time in, get it over with. You know, I want to serve. I have an obligation to serve, I believe, but I just want to put my time in, and I just want to go on from there. And the Army seemed like the quickest way to do that.
Get it done. What did your parents think about it?
Oh, my dad had died, but my mom was not happy. She was not happy at all, but she knew that I really didn't have any other choices at all, so... It was sad, because my dad had died just a year earlier than that. Wow. And she's like, oh, I don't want to lose, you know, another one to mm-hmm. Vietnam. So it was very sad, kind Hard of sad, time. Emotional time. Sure. Yeah.
Wow.
But tell me about your, uh-huh. you going in.
So mine was, interesting. So yours was at the end of a war, and mine was more or less at the beginning. I joined post 9/11. So 9/11 happened in the fall of my second year of college. So I was in college, okay. Giving it my all, but maybe not the best of will in there. I wasn't doing terrible, but I had no real aspirations for what I was going to do after college. And then 9/11 happened. And, you know, there was the rush to serve. There was the rush, you know, there were lines of people, you know, and recruitment areas in New York. And I remember thinking that this was a purpose, that this would be something that I could do that would actually have meaning. And I felt severely lacking at that time in my life.
So you had 2 years of college roughly, and then you opted to...
Yep. And so I went in that Christmas after 9/11, that winter, and signed in. They wanted me to finish my spring semester before going in. So I was delayed entry, I believe it was called. Yeah. And then I went into... So I made basic training just in time for the summer. And then I joined on up and did... 6.5 years with stop loss, because we did a. I was on my last combat tour during Bush's final. I think it was one of his final pushes that he did as president, and we did 6.5 years, did 3 combat tours.
You went in as an enlisted person.
I did go in enlisted. Okay. I did not graduate before going in. So
did they offer you OCS while you were in there?
There was a warrant school, so as a warrant officer was discussed. I went in under intelligence. I did tactical intelligence, so we talked about that, and that was a discussion. But I was, after experiencing it for a number of years, and the tours and the back and forth, and I remember talking to even colonels, you know, in intelligence, you're kind of surrounded by some an interesting mix that you would not normally see, and people talking about, you know, 19 years in the service, and they didn't know if they were going to make it one more. That they were breaking down. Yeah. It was just too much war, too much time away, and I'm like, that doesn't seem like something I was ready to add more time onto. Already a pretty lengthy.
You were not married at the time.
I was not married, and I wanted to be married, and I didn't. Kind of like you breaking up before, you know, making sure you had no attachments going in. Yeah. I was in. And I didn't want to develop an attachment because I did not see – I saw the pain of a lot of loss from loss of life. I remember going to funerals from people, friends that were – and widows now, you know, and seeing that and then also just broken marriages. You know, you can only be away for so long before, you know, just you're not fulfilling a emotional need that you both need.
Yes.
So I was ready to get out.
So your MOS was actually in military intelligence, is that correct?
I was a signals intelligence was what I signed up for. I was going to be an analyst somewhere. I think I was trained for the NSA. We were actually in San Angelo, Texas, is where they do the training for that. And so I was the only time, first time I'd ever been to Texas. And then until now living in there.
Not Fort Huachuca?
Not Fort Huachuca. Fort Huachuca is a different group. They're the listeners and also some other things they do there.
Spooky things they do
there. The spooky things that they're trained on there, at least. They do a lot of training. I was in San Angelo where they trained firefighters and signals intelligence analysts.
Interesting. So did you think you'd ever end up like with NSA or something like that?
There was a couple times, I think, early on, or actually middle, maybe in the middle. I think I was pretty, you know, I went through the training, and then I went to airborne school, and jumped out of some airplanes, and then I joined the 82nd Airborne Division. And then and I think I was a little gung-ho somewhere in there for a while, you know, and we were in the initial evasion right after the Marines went through and Special Forces. We were the regular guys that rolled in after everybody else had come through in that invasion.
In Iraq.
I never set foot in Afghanistan. A number of different units were pulled and platoons and support elements for, you know, intelligence in Afghanistan. It just, every cycle, it just missed me. And so I was always in Iraq. And so I kind of saw the start, not to finish, because finish is a hard word to describe our state, but definitely the start, definitely from the start and the general, I would say, degradation or the falling apart of a nation to watch it happen, because years would jump by and then I'd do another combat tour and you kind of watch how the nation changed. And it was almost...
You're talking about Iraq now, though, right?
It is, and just watching Baghdad kind of change, because I was, for some reason, always sent back to Baghdad. And so it was really fascinating looking at it change through the years. But, yeah.
You know, it's kind of interesting. You study a little bit about the war and they talk about how, you know, we went in with the intention of nation building. We thought we'd establish a regime that was friendly to the U.S. And as it turned out, that didn't happen at all. I mean, they hate us now.
Yeah.
Probably even worse. And it's just, you know, we went in with such strong, noble ideals, and it just never panned out. The ones that I've never been there, but the people I've been there said they were not impressed with Iraq at all. So they just thought they've got troubles, that they're going to continue to have troubles for the next several hundred years. I don't know if that's your impression or not, but
yeah, it's a hard setup there. The initially I think it could have been something different, yeah. And it was handled very poorly.
Yeah.
I think I was shot at one time in a little over a year of my first combat tour, and that's the initial invasion.
Yeah.
I remember hiding in bunkers in Kuwait when they were having the Scud, alarms, because they were worried about chemical weapons, and and we were brought in there, and there was nothing. You know, it's like, all right, we've destroyed the regime.
Yeah.
Now what? And it was this yes. pause and this breath of expectation, and it was hopeful. I remember we met with locals who were super happy, and it was different. I remember we rolled around in Humvees without doors. You know, we didn't have tops on the vehicles.
Yeah.
They were old Vietnam, era. You know, the woodland camel green, olive green vehicles, and we just didn't have doors, didn't have roofs. We just kind of rolled around. We had a piece of plywood over the top of a cab, and I'd set up a M40 machine gun on top of that, and we just roll through the city, and that was about it.
Yeah.
And I never was. I think I was shot at once. And I think it was more of like, I think that was directed our way.
Did someone, someone shoot at me?
Yeah, there was definitely shooting, and I think it might have been directed towards us. I should get down. So that loves, like, it was miserable. It's 130 degree temperatures, and you don't even have a fan. But so I mean, it was a miserable time. But it wasn't I never really felt particularly like it was life on the line, at least for my experiences.
Yeah. How long was each deployment?
So the first combat tour was 1 year, a little over a year. Second one was actually only 3 months, but I was injured during one of our combat maneuvers. So second combat tour, we were assigned to JSOC. I don't know if you are familiar with Joint Special Operations.
Yeah.
And so we were just the nerds who helped the, what do they call them, the door kicker,
eater,
the tough guys. Yeah. And so we were just the nerds. But I handled signals intelligence. So if there was a cell phone, I was to handle it, as that would be. And so we were assigned to them and took mortar fire on, I think it was only my third operation that we were doing. And that was all over, anywhere that was necessary in Iraq. And we took mortar fire, and I think like 8 people did not make it. A good lieutenant friend of mine.
Wow.
That was a hard one. That one, that was the first, like, that was a hard one. And then I was injured and eventually not bad. It was basically I just took a rolled around, like the concussion knocked me around a bit and it dislocated, rolled my ankle basically. But enough that it was popped out, like the ankle was dislocated, and then we had to go about 23K walking on it, and it was mush by the time I was done. And so they were like, "That's not getting better. You need to go home." So I was sent back pretty early on that one.
Interesting.
But
just as a side note, I think of this, when I got out of the Army, I was a veterans counselor. I'd help veterans file for benefits. Have you filed for benefits?
Just filed for benefits. I'm talking like 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
I finally broke down
and
filed for some benefits.
See, it's always been amazing to me. There's always been a hesitancy on the veterans' part to say, I want to go in and file for this because they have some kind of a pre-bias, maybe against the VA or just maybe because you're still somewhat angry at the military. But I've actually helped a lot of people actually file for benefits, and I was going to say you need to file if you haven't already.
It was more so. I remember being on an airplane shipping back from to Germany, and they were like, you can't just jump on an airplane and be heard and ship back. Like, there is a protocol. And so I'm like strapped down to this to this mat, and they're like, it's a bad ankle, but it's a bankle, you know. And they're like, what's your pain threshold? 1 to 10. We have our pain medications here, which pre opioid crisis that we're aware of. But
I remember
there was a special forces guy next to me, and they had stopped bleeding, and what I found out later were 3 bullet wounds. And he was 3. His answer was 3, and I was like, oh, I'm going to have to go with a one. Maybe zero. Is there a negative number?
Yeah.
I'm like, it hurt like hell, but it was like, if that's a three, I'm going and I think that was a hard one for me to get over. You know, when I saw what others had given up, it was hard for me to be like, well, where's mine? Yeah. And I was like, I'm okay.
This is nothing.
I can get through this. And so, I finally did. I finally broke down and I was like, you know, there's enough old, you know, grease in the gears that I needed that I'm like, you know what? I need to just file.
Well, you file only because it will give you difficulty later on. Yeah. I can say personally that your body decays and get arthritis and you'll have problems with that. So you need to document that.
So then real quick. That was my second tour. That was hard. And then I was back for maybe 4 months. And then I did a
third.
And then I did a third tour, and that was they literally canceled Christmas. So we were getting ready. Everyone was getting ready to go to a Christmas. I came back in the fall. You know, it was in summer I deployed. I came back in the fall 3 months later, and then come Christmas time, everyone's getting ready to go see their families, and they were like told quietly, no, and it was like, oh, and they're like, get ready, and I remember. Because we had that was kind of the 82nd Airborne's thing, 18 hours anywhere on the planet. Mm-hmm. We can be anywhere on the planet in 18 hours ready for war. And they were like, yeah, that's happening. So right now. And we got all our gear together and they gave us a safety brief. They were, did they have those back in then? Did they have the safety brief? Or like, all right. Like, before you leave here tonight, you need to
take care of business.
Like, we're officially checking the boxes of the things that we told you not to do. So if you do them, we can get you in trouble, I feel like. But did they have, like...
No, we deployed twice to Germany. You know, they took the entire 1st Infantry Division over to Germany for war maneuvers. But we knew it was coming. I mean, we knew every year it was coming, so we had time to prepare for it, so... It was nothing compared to.
But it was funny because it was on New Year's Eve and we were deploying and they were like, you know, everyone needs to be here tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. to deploy. Yeah. And it's funny because I don't think the commanders, like, it didn't click that it was New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
And they were like, and I remember people rolling on in smelling like a brewery.
Yeah.
And it's like, what are they going to do? Like,
we're going
to war.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you're going to get, I guess we could get in trouble, but we're already.
Well, you always wonder who planned this. I mean, why did you pick New Year's Eve? It's like, guys, you couldn't put this back 2 days. It's not going to make a difference at all. But you always wonder who's behind the planning on that.
Yeah.
When, based now what you've seen in Iraq, you know, from being there personally and then what you see on the news, what's happening today. Any comments on that? Like political comments in terms of this is good, this is bad, this is not worthwhile.
It's one of those where it's hard to envision unbreaking it. You know that you break the dish shatters on the floor, and it's hard to envision getting all the pieces and gluing it back together, and that it's going to hold water.
Yeah,
you know that it's.
That's a good analogy. I like that. I like that.
So you can put it back together, but it's still I remember when we were first. I remember being in Baghdad, and they were trying to get water working in the city. Yeah. There was no water, and I don't know who she was, but I was told she was a college graduate who is a friend of the Bushes, and that it was her job to get water running in the city of Baghdad. And as far as I'm aware, it never, you know, that like I left before it got working.
Yeah, never.
And it was, and I remember thinking it was just people were looking at resume patterns and things like that instead of actually doing the job. And it felt hard because it's like, shouldn't we be putting our best? And I remember third combat tour, we were just holding stock. We were on a hunting team.
Yeah.
That was my hardest one. That was a year and a half, and I would get a name and a number, maybe a location, and then we would develop a target package and we would hunt them. And we would hunt them down. And maybe I'd get a Y, but a lot of times not. Yeah. And that was the hardest one. That was definitely the most action, the most combat, the most fighting. And that was a hard one.
I just getting back to your comment about, you know, the friend of the Bushes, I just, you know, when you go back and look at this, you said, I can't believe President Bush didn't have any advisor who stood up to him and said, going in there and trying to make friends of a group of people that hate us is not going to work. I said, they have a completely different mindset. I don't know who his Mideast advisors were, maybe other than Cheney, who wanted to go in there and, you know, do all kinds of great things, or Rumsfeld, who said we could do it with 50,000 troops. But he needed to have someone in there who
understood
could,
Middle Eastern
culture. Culture, and say, you don't understand. If we go in there and take out this regime, they're going to align themselves with Iran. They can't help but align themselves with Iran, because this is a Shiite majority you're dealing with. It's not a Sunni majority. But apparently no one ever sat down and talked to him and said, this is the way it's going to be. It's not going to work like it did with Germany or Japan, you know, 50 years sooner. This is going to be really ugly. And they're still going to hate the U.S., regardless of, even though we've gotten rid of one dictator that, anyway, I digress. Yeah. We kind of got off topic.
No, that's a really good topic. I was, there's a lot of, especially the first combat tour, I just sat in an office and analyzed things and communications and, you know, there was no cell structure. Yeah. There wasn't even cell, you know, they didn't even have towers at the time. So, you know, there's not much for us to do there. And so it was kind of chill in the main office. But I remember, like, CIA would bring, they're like, hey, we have the entire police force. Everybody's here, up, commanders on down, ready to come to work for the Americans. We pay them, and they will get going. And they told them to go home.
Thank you.
And they told them to go home. They're like,
thank you.
They worked for the previous regime. Yeah, tell them to go away. No. And it's like,
no.
It was so, you know, so it just idiotic, like that. Yes. That's actually why I didn't actually end up going NSA afterwards. Where I've just kind of like, there's amazing patriotic people who did amazing things for the government, and then a political force or an incompetent force would be thrown in there, and you could see them just speechless.
Yes.
And, you know, I feel like there's something with that, you know, is we're both teachers and we both see the forces that sometimes align and political or, you know, that are like, that doesn't make any sense for the job. But there seems when it was life or death, like these are life and death decisions. And it was like, there was no, there was no one to stop and say, wait. You know,
let's step back and take a look at this and say, this is maybe
is this
not the
truly
right.
Truly the best, you know.
Yeah, what we want to do. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. So you got out of the service, and then you said you were interested in medical school then at that point.
Yeah, right? So I went back to school, went all the way, got my undergrad, and then went to medical school, actually.
In biology?
I actually got a double degree. I did molecular biology and English.
What would that be like? Yeah, I never had that interest in doing the double.
It was I got the English degree and I knocked it out in 2 years and it seemed not too hard and then I was like I had met my soon to be wife and we were talking and I always loved the idea of medicine and she's like, why not, you know, the worst that will happen is you just will fail, you know, and you have other things than if that happens
other
and
options.
So I did it. I did not fail. Got into medical school and was in a really bad car accident actually. That was a big thing in life. Took me out of it.
Several months.
Yeah. It did. And then when I get back in, we had had our first child, and I didn't have the fire. I didn't have the will to study 8 hours a day. Yeah. You know, to lose the time. You know, I've been putting my daughter to bed every night. You know, I wasn't ready to give that up.
It's a good thing. Yeah, it's a good thing.
And Texas offers an alternative certificate to education. I'm sure you are aware, unless you went back to school for your licensure. And so we signed up for that, and we had family living in El Paso at the time. And so we packed all our things up and rolled on over to El Paso.
So having been in the military and then now teaching, what are some of the life lessons you can incorporate with your kids then at that point? Anything?
I think a lot. I think there's a lot. I think a big one is, you know, understanding perspective. I think, and I think that's probably for every job out there that you get lost in the minutia and every little thing is a rise and fall and a desperate, you know, assault on who you are as an educator, and it's like, or that this student failed this assignment, and what are they getting out of life if they can't? And it's like,
Wow. Is there any hope for that? Is there any hope for that student?
Yeah, is the student light gone? Yeah, the light is gone. They are failures, and they will never get it unless they truly feel the pain of that zero. And it's like, well,
maybe not.
That there may be a broader lesson that we could teach them than the pain of that. And what about you? I mean, what do you think coming into?
Well, I think part of it is what we were talking about earlier. I can just share them a perspective because they're a lot of them had the attitude education's way too expensive. I can't afford it now. I said, well, no, there's some ways you can do that. I said, you go in the military. I said, not everyone may be cut out for the military, but look at this. You can go into the Coast Guard. You can rescue crazy fishermen who've gotten themselves in a jam. Uh-huh. You can save people and get your military credit that way. Go into the Coast Guard and they'll pay for your school. I said, so that's one way to do it. And just to encourage them, that's an option that they have. They didn't think they have. And also, probably going along with what you're saying, is just give them the perspective, like, there's kind of a being part of something, a greater good of some sort, and that it's not maybe always about yourself, and that some of the maturing process that goes on in the military has strong life lessons, because you can realize that the situation that I thought was a crisis is not really a crisis. It's not really that big of a deal compared to some other things that I've really seen, especially in the military. So it's like, this is fine. I mean, you'll adjust to life. You can cope with life. I think you have better coping skills having experienced some of the military benefits. And again, a lot of my students, I realize they're probably not cut out for a military type life. Yes. I mean, they probably can't relate to that, but nevertheless, I think there's a certain group out there that will appeal to. So I try and impart some of the lessons that, hey, this is part of life, and you guys can be successful at this if you just realize this is not the end of the world if you break up with your girlfriend or your boyfriend or something like that. So I guess maybe that's the big one. I try and communicate that to the students.
And I know even for my own, you know, that I listen to other teachers talk about, you know, this person failed this and, you know, they'll never, you know, they can't figure it out. And it's like, well, you know, we have to work with them. And it's like, but they don't care. I'm like, well, then they'll fail and it's okay. And they'll still have hope. Like,
that's,
that there's okay, that it's not the...
My students probably define my teaching style as being, if they were probably describing and say, oh, Mr. Lott, he's a really nice guy. And that's, I try and help them as much as I can, and it costs me nothing. And I thought, some really appreciate it. Some maybe don't appreciate it so much, but maybe it's someday they'll look back and say, you know, someone was helping me, and I can play it forward a little bit, and I can maybe help someone else in something along the way. So, you know, we'll see. I don't know if that's true or not, but we'll see what happens with that.
Time will tell.
Yeah, time will tell.
But, how do you like teaching? Yeah.
Oh, I love it. I love it. The personal rewards are great. It's kind of interesting. I went to college, and
What did you major in?
Yeah, well, I majored in phys ed and recreation. I thought I was going to be a teacher. I wanted
so
to be
you
a teacher, yeah.
Wow.
And I was certified as a teacher.
Oh, wow.
But then I got drafted, spent a couple of years as a military policeman. I'd been interested in law enforcement as well. And I thought, well, that sounds kind of interesting. So I went into, you know, as a military policeman, got out, started working as a veterans counselor, and a friend of mine said, you should think about the FBI. And I said, no, the FBI always wants just accountants or attorneys. He said, no. He said, Hoover wanted everyone to believe you had to be an accountant or an attorney, but that's not true. It's a very diverse workforce. So I put an application in, did well on the test. God took me in a completely different direction than I had ever intended. I ended up working, you know, 28 years in FBI, which I really enjoyed. I thought that was the coolest job in the whole world.
Wow.
But then, you know, after retiring, you retire. It's mandatory retirement at age 57. And I thought, I don't want to retire yet. So I thought, let me go back to teaching. And I really, really enjoyed it. Even as an FBI agent, I was an instructor. I was a general police instructor, and I always enjoyed that. I just have enjoyed teaching, and especially even my wife teaches music, and we both reflect on it's a big reward for us when our students get some accolades or something like that, because we really feel like, hey, and they come up and thank you and say, my wife got recently thanked for, the student said, yeah, you've just been a real mentor to me and you've helped me all the way through high school. And that's a big payoff. To me, that's worth more than anything else I could get maybe in a paycheck. But it's a big payoff just from some of the notes I've gotten from some of the students saying, oh, Mr. Lott, you've really helped me with this, helped me with that. Thanks for helping it. And it's just you've gotten the same thing. I'm sure you probably realize it's a big payoff.
You could just look the look of pride on their face and then being able to tell you, and it's like, oh, I'm majoring in, you know, microbiology.
Microbiology, you know, it inspired me to go into microbiology.
Yeah, inspired you to follow you, you know, and it's something that and it's funny that I don't necessarily even think in my head of that being a goal, you know, convince people to come over. I'm like, oh, I just wanna try to make it as fun as possible while you learn and hopefully experience something and you can take away something that you will remember afterwards and
for the rest of your life.
Yeah, and now you're going to UT Austin and majoring in molecular microbiology. Cool. I'm like, oh, wow, I wasn't really like that. That touches, leaves an impact.
My wife, as I said, teaches music. One of her students thought he was going to go somewhere out on the East Coast, you know, one of the really high powered schools. Decided eventually to go to UTEP. UTEP got a new clarinet teacher in there, and the clarinet teacher was very complimentary to my wife, said, you've done a really good job with him. You know, you've just brought him along. He's just tearing it up. And that meant a lot to my wife. My wife just said, you know, I'm glad I've inspired someone. I've been able to touch someone. And she's got a couple of other students now that they're looking at. And she said, this is really cool. So nice to get as I said, a payoff like that.
It's a recognition of that. And I think I don't know if that I'm sure with the FBI too, the content or the idea of mentorship.
Yeah.
And I think that is, you know, and if all you think of is education, you know, as a way to just deliver material, then I think, you know, you're doing it a disservice.
Yes.
Just like in the service or the FBI or any other thing. And I feel like that connection probably is what really fits for me or makes it really connect.
And that's, going back to the FBI, that's, you felt like you were part of something bigger, a greater good of some sort. You were doing, they were paying me to put the bad guys in jail. I thought, how cool is that? So what a great deal. You know, it's like, anything else? I'm sorry. Sure.
Can you share with David one of your fondest memories from your time in the FBI?
This will sound strange. Some of my students ask me sometime about some of the cases I worked on. I worked on some really good cases. You know, the Unabomber case, which went on for like 14 years. I was in Waco when David Koresh was there. Our SWAT team was there.
Wow.
But one of the most rewarding things was it was just a kidnapping. A 14 and 15-year-old girl had been kidnapped from El Paso, and the police came to me and said, hey, we're not having much luck with this. Can you help us with that? And I had a daughter about the same age at the time, so we went out and talked to they had a suspect. They think it was more of a kind of a runaway type kidnapping. We can work it as a kidnapping. But I went to the a friend, another fellow Asian, I went to the father, and we kind of leaned on him pretty heavy saying, you know, do you know where your son is? Well, no, of course I don't. Well, we think you know where he is. Listen, it's very important. Mm-hmm. We're the FBI. We're looking for him. He's in a lot of trouble. That night, they got a call saying their daughter was up in Albuquerque and was at the bus stop. He had dropped her off and said, so I just helped, you know, bring her back. I mean, a lot of personal satisfaction just from helping both girls returned home safely, just because, and more importantly than anything, it was just we had the name of the FBI, the brand name of the FBI, and go with the fact we went and talked to him. He suddenly got scared, called his son, who he knew was up in Albuquerque, and said, hey, you better, you know, put them on a bus, get them back to the bus. So it's just, that's just a personal satisfaction case. Thank you.
David, can you share with Tom one of your favorite fondest memories from teaching or maybe meeting your wife or something like that?
So it's funny. So when I went back to school, you know, as kind of a disconnect between me and the other students, as I'm significantly older than everyone else, going out of order. I caution students now too. I'm like, I think it's great going military first. Be aware it's a little scarier going back in because you're not in the same position as everyone else.
You're more mature.
And so, you know, getting invited to a house party at 24. six is not as appealing maybe as it might have been at 18 or something. Yeah. And I remember going to the lab. They had a language lab there, and I remember going there to study and just kind of work. And the lady, a young lady who was working it, was my would one day be my wife. Was, and she managed a lab. She was getting her master's in Spanish. She had just come back from the Peace Corps, actually, in Paraguay. And we had met the – it's funny that I had just come out of the military and she had just got out of the Peace Corps. And we both, I think, felt a little disconnected from the people around us, and we found a connection within each other. Mm-hmm. And I remember going out and having a conversation and just never wanting to stop talking with her.
Developed an instantaneous connection there and said, let's continue this. Yeah. Let's keep this going. Good for you. That's good, though.
And I was, consider myself quite lucky.
Yeah, that's good. Anything else you'd like to add? I think I'm pretty well covered it here, but I don't I think we both had an I feel like I've had an opportunity to say some things, so anything else you'd like to talk about, Dave, or
I think that was good.
I think we're all right.